Okay, it's 8 o'clock, so why don't we do a roll call, please?
Chair Page?
Here.
Vice Chair McMichael?
Here.
Regent Geddes?
Here.
Regent Hayes?
Here.
Regent Levine?
Here.
Regent Trachok?
He's taking roll.
You have a quorum.
Thank you. Okay, let's go to agenda item number one, public comment. Do you have any public comment in Reno? I'm going to take that as a no. Okay, any public comment in Elko?
Hi, Chair Page. You have no public comment.
Chair Page?
Yes.
It should be all be in an email or a voice message, the board.
Okay. Okay, perfect. And I have neither, so I'm assuming that we have no public comment. Just want to confirm that?
Correct.
Perfect. Okay. With that, we'll go to agenda item number two, minutes. We have a motion for approval.
So moved. Geddes.
So motion from Regent Geddes. Do we have a second?
Second, Regent McMichael.
Thank you, Regent McMichael. Any discussion? Seeing none, can we do a roll call vote?
Yes, thank you. Vice Chair McMichael?
Yes.
Regent Geddes?
Aye.
Regent Hayes?
Yes.
Regent Levine?
Yes.
Regent Trachok? Chair Page?
Yes.
Motion passes.
Thank you. With that, we'll go to agenda item number three, Chair's Report. Just one thing to remember, today's 9/11, so just try to keep think that throughout the day. It's unbelievable. It was 19 years ago today. And with that, we're going to go to agenda item number four, Enchi Northern Command information. Chief Redwick.
Hi, Chair Page. Thank you. For the record, my name's Todd Renwick. I'm the Assistant Vice President.
Heidi, what's the question across?
For Police Services Northern Command. I just want to welcome Chancellor Rose and President Whitfield to Nevada and our Enchi family, so welcome. And Chancellor Riley, I just want to say thank you for your leadership, especially during our consolidation days and making that concept come to reality. So thank you for all that. And Chair Page, I think this is your last meeting. So I want to say thank you for your leadership and working with us through the years.
Thanks.
If we can go ahead and advance the slide, we're going to be talking about our Northern Command initiatives and diversity training. And as you can see up here, for the last several years, we've been doing a lot as it relates to diversity training and leadership in diversity. All these topics up here have been classes that officers and the department have taken. These are classes that will continue to be ongoing. We incorporate this into our new hire. So when our officers come out of the academy, we put them through and are going to continue to put them through these types of training as they advance into our department and into the patrol operations. If you can advance the slide here. So in addition to these trainings, I just wanted to highlight these two pictures because for me, they mean a lot. The picture on the left is a training that we did last year with our LGBTQIA community, where the entire department, over two sessions met with this group, and we learned terminology, we learned transgender issues. We were able to have open dialogue with each other, so police officers in dialogue with the community to learn about them and vice versa. And I think what I'm proud about this today is I still have relationships with members of this community where we meet every other week. And really, our meetings are, we just sit and chat and talk, and we've gotten to know each other, and I'm really valuing that relationship that has come out of that. In fact, some of the members of this community come in and do ride-alongs or even just have coffee with the officers. So that was a really valuable training that we did with that community. On the right was a training we did with Guardian Quest. It was leadership and diversity a few years ago. Again, the entire department, and we had opened it up for other members of the university to go through. This is Angie Taylor's group, and it was another great training, and I can tell you that the officers raved about this training, and it was really rewarding at the end when we all came out, even with other members of our university community. If you can advance that slide. So some of you probably are familiar with, if you're not, there was a campaign that came out after the George Floyd incident, hashtag 8CantWait. It was a reform for policies. What we were proud of is of these eight policies that they wanted reform on, at the time we were in compliance with six. We are now in compliance with all eight of what this campaign was asking for. And really what was nice is like policies like duty to intervene. We had already had this policy in our policies and procedures where if an officer sees another officer doing something wrong and they don't intervene, they will be held accountable as well. In addition to this duty to intervene, we have a duty to intervene on anti-bias policing as well. On the chokeholds, we never really had a chokehold in our policies, but we did have what was called the carotid that we had removed from our policies. So when you look at the requiring de-escalation, I'm going to talk about this and some training that we initiated. And then all of the other policies, it was nice to know that we were ahead of the game and in compliance with that. Advance the slide, please. So the de-escalation training, we sought out, we had officers in our training section seek out training for de-escalation, and we found some training through PERF, the Police Executive Research Forum, and our officers developed a presentation and class that was certified through our Peace Officer Standards and Training Division for the state, where we have now a certified lesson plan as well as instructors that can teach this de-escalation training. And I'm really proud of that because this was initiated by our training division and officers. This didn't come down from the top, although we were looking at ways that we could look at de-escalation. They went out and found a really valuable class that could be delivered to our department, which everyone in our department has gone through. Really, it focuses on situations involving persons who are unarmed or armed with weapons other than firearms and who may be experiencing a mental health or other crisis. And some of this incorporates, some of you may remember the verbal judo days where, you know, we practice communication skills. So to me, it reminded me some of verbal judo, but real practical scenarios. So 4 hours of the class is the lecture and talking about that and watching videos of real situations and debriefing them. And then the other 4 hours is actual practical scenarios that officers are put through to evaluate how they absorb this information in the class and then talk about the outcomes of those practicals. So again, really proud of the fact that we took that lead and now actually we're gonna be presenting some of these classes to DPS from their request. So was really proud of that. You can advance the slide, please. So the other thing is, I had mentioned in one of our forums with Chancellor Riley about a relationship we have with our School of Social Work. So we have two interns now currently working in our department from the School of Social Work. They're riding with our patrol officers and responding to calls with homeless population and those that are suffering mental health issues. And this is a great relationship because I think they're getting a great field experience right now. And we have an opportunity to show them the things that we're dealing with in real world. And we get to hear from them about some of their experiences and what they're learning going through their program. So this is really, I think, going to be a great relationship. And I also have three command personnel right now who are taking a course through the School of Social Work, structural oppression. And this was another relationship that we entered into with Dean Shadi Martin, who's been a champion at helping get us to this point. And so we have officers eventually that will be continuing to take that class that they offer. So again, another thing I'm really proud about because these officers are, I think, enjoying it. It's especially the command staff, they're coming back and they're talking about things that they're learning and discussing in class with actual other students. So it's really turning out to be a perfect relationship. If you can advance that slide. Just in our advisory boards, we are revising our advisory boards to be more institution specific. Currently, as it's written, we have advisory boards from members of all the institutions that we serve in the North. And quite honestly, I think that's maybe a little bit too big because each campus has their own specific needs and demographics. So we want to be able to cater our services to each one of those campuses. So we're actually right now revising and reforming UNR's advisory board. And I think once we get the foundation to that, then we'll work with the other institutions, TMCC, WNC, Great Basin, and DRI, which I'm assuming DRI is probably just going to be with TMCC because they're neighbors and they're so close that we could probably keep those two as one. But that's one of the initiatives we're doing now on the advisory board. And then we're also working with the system office right now on revising our Board of Professional Standards, which we've been active in reviewing, having campus community members review our internal affairs investigations that have been conducted. And that right now is actively being rewritten at the system level. If we can advance again. Our body cameras, we have been wearing body cameras actually since 2014. We started implementing body cameras at that time. We didn't have enough for everybody, but in 2015, we were 100% compliance. And this was prior to the legislation, which went into effect in July 1st, 2018. So if you see there on the right, you'll see the actual body camera. That's what it looks like. And then how it's worn, you'll see on Officer Green's chest where the body camera goes and how it's worn. And all of our officers have them. And again, another thing that initiative-wise, we never heard grumblings or had issues with officers having to wear body cameras, just part of their uniform now. If we can advance that again. And then just diving a little deeper in kind of taking a look at our department. We looked at our traffic citations. This is a total of traffic citations that we have written for 2019. And part of this is the number one complaint that comes into my office during a full academic year is traffic and pedestrian complaints, either speeders or pedestrians. And so we're fairly aggressive in traffic safety and even seeking grants. I mean, we get between $20,000 and $30,000 a year through the Office of Traffic Safety to be able to do these types of enforcements. But then we wanted to look at, you know, who are we stopping and what's that breakdown? And this just gives you an idea of the citations by race that we did out of the 582 citations we wrote in 2019. If you can advance that slide. digging a little deeper, we looked at our arrests. We looked at our arrests by race and student status. And as you can see, it was pretty interesting on the left. And this is kind of known to us, but for you all, you may see the difference that I'm talking about. Our non-student population that comes onto campus that we interact with and sometimes have to end up arresting are the stats you see there on the left, and a breakdown of race. And then on the middle, you'll see the student status breakdown. What that really tells us is, you know, obviously our non-student population is the population that we're dealing with more than actually our students as it relates to arrests. And I will tell you this, our students don't really commit crimes on each other. Every so often it happens, but really what we have is our students that make poor decisions that have to face some sort of consequence, and it may be an arrest through alcohol violations or drug violations. And then we do on occasions get an unknown student status that we just don't know. We don't have access to student information, so sometimes we just don't get that actual information. And if we can advance one more. This is another issue where we dove into to take a look at, because I've had these questions come up in forums about, you know, what does our department look like and what are our education levels? So if you look at the left side, that's a breakdown of what our department is now. And my pitch has been everywhere I go, and I'll make this pitch to you all. If you know qualified, diverse applicants, please send them my way. Not down south to Director Garcia, but I can tell you that we are all competing for diverse applicants in our areas. And every pitch I make when I go to classes or I talk to student groups or faculty is, if you know diverse applicants that are interested in law enforcement, please send them our way. We still do recruitment efforts out of state and other areas to draw in applicants, but it's a never stop continuing whatever we can do battle to recruit diverse applicants. And then on the right is our education levels. And one of the things that I'm really proud about is if you look at the INSHE alumni far right, 35 of our department members are INSHE alumni from some institution in INSHE. And then when you look at the left side with our bachelor's level and our associate's level, we're really encouraging and pushing our officers towards the educational piece, higher educational piece. So that's another effort. And we have a lot of our officers that have gone to school on these campuses and now returning back to police them. And that says something. That says their desire to be here, to be at this police department, providing police services to our institutions. We can advance that. So that's SAPA, one of our explosive detection dogs, and that's SAPA's handler, Robin Wasser, but I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Chief. Hey, quick question for you. When you go back to the number 8, Cam Waite, and you said you had 6 of the 8, which 2 did you not have implemented?
Yeah, so on the carotid hold that I was telling you about, in the banning choke holds and the carotid, so we still had the carotid technique in our policy that we have since removed. And then the other one is the having the force continuum. We changed some language to make it more appropriate to what they're asking, as far as, you know, in the old days, we used to have the ladder, which was when you show up at your physical presence, your uniform, then you use a verbal command, then you use light touch, and then you use techniques that are appropriate to someone resisting all the way up to deadly force. That really doesn't work in our world, because we could have an officer who shows up and immediately has to go to a deadly force option. And so we changed the language in our policy to make sure that an officer uses every de-escalation piece before having to use any sort of deadly force.
Any questions from the board?
Chair Page, this is Lisa. Can I ask a question, please?
Sure.
Thank you. Officer Renwick, first and foremost, I come from a long line of family of New Yorkers, so I just want to say today thank you. It's a reminder that when folks are running away from buildings on those tragic moments, officers are running in. So thank you for your service. I have one question for you, and if it's wrong, then fine. I just want to hear it. Can you go back to some of the demographic charts that you had just showing the breakdowns of race, of students and non-students arrested, please?
Sure. I don't have control of it, so if whoever had that PowerPoint could do that for me. Thank you, Regent Levine.
As they're pulling that up, I just wanted to ask you, I appreciate these visuals. I'm also reminded the demographics of Reno. What are they? What's the breakdown of just kind of the regional metropolitan staging area that Reno's in that you're serving that are non-students, white versus African-American versus Hispanic?
Well, I don't really have those at my hand. I could get those for you, but I wouldn't want to misquote or misrepresent that.
Okay, understood. I guess my reasoning for asking is that while I understand the purpose of this chart, without seeing the demographics, it could be still disproportionately affecting some more than others. And that was my purpose of asking you. And so just next time, if you could include those numbers for the presentation, I'd appreciate it. I think it's an important part. Thank you.
No, thank you, Regent Levine.
Thank you. We're going to go to Regent Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Once again, I will echo what my counterpart said. Thank you, Chief Renwick, for your service. And I still use verbal judo today, so that is, it really works. How often are the trainings? I know you did a very good job of listing the trainings that were for special populations or different populations. How often do you go through those trainings? And secondly, is UPD post one certified or post two?
So thank you, Regent Perkins. We are, and Todd Renwick for the record, we are category one peace officers. The training that we do on the diversity initiatives, some's monthly, some's every 6 months. It depends as they come up and the trainings that we find. We've had some officers sign up for some virtual training. I think we had one this week that was in our conference room doing some virtual training on another diversity-related topic. So as they come up, and for sure department-wide, annually and at least every 6 months, we're doing some form of training.
Last question. And are they mandatory trainings, or do you get to pick and choose? Is it like a cafeteria style, or do you have to go through all of them?
So, Regent Perkins, Todd Renwick for the record, yes and no. So officers can seek out and take and find specific training. The topics that we identify and want everybody to go through is mandatory. And if you're on annual leave, at some point you're going to be taking that training when you come back.
Thank you so much, and that's all my questions.
Thank you. Do you have any questions from the institutions? Okay, seeing none, thank you, Chief, for your presentation. We're going to agenda item number 5, NC Southern Command. Chief Garcia.
Good morning, Chair Page, committee members, Chancellor Rose, and presidents. For the record, my name is Adam Garcia, Vice President for Public Safety Services and Director of University Police Services Southern Command. My department provides public safety services to UNLV, DRI, Nevada State College, CSN and ENSHE in Southern Nevada. A central tenet of University Police Services is our commitment to our campuses. Since its consolidation early last year, we have worked on cultural shift from traditional policing to a true community-oriented policing model based on transparency, accountability, empathy, responsiveness, and appropriate visibility. This cultural shift in many, many ways is seismic. And I wanted to provide you, in light of recent national events, an update of the changes which are reflective of my commitment to you, to our students, our faculty, staff, and to our entire community. Slide two, please. Next slide. First of all, I wanted to share with you my feelings about the recent events across the nation, in particular the death of George Floyd. I believe that event was callous, it was sickening, and as a police professional for 41 years, deeply disturbing. This includes those officers who stood by and did nothing. These unacceptable actions are not who we are, nor who we should ever be. Any officer, either my department or anywhere in this nation, who supports the actions of these officers in any way need to turn in their badges and seek an alternative career path. The death of Mr. Floyd is a very, very painful reminder that much work remains before us, and we at UPD have begun that journey. For instance, we have reinforced with our department employees our policy which prohibits chokeholds and similar uses of force. We have strengthened the department policy which required employees to intervene when other employees either fail to perform their duties or their conduct is in violation of policy or ethically inappropriate. Failure to do so had subjected the officers to discipline, but the policy has now been revised and clearly states up to and including termination and or prosecution. The department is in the process of creating a policy and establishing an early warning system, which is designed to identify officers whose behavior is problematic and to provide a form of intervention to correct that behavior, whether through training or discipline. Next slide, please. The department continues to move to self-sufficiency and less reliance on other police agencies, while we must maintain cooperative agreements which are needed in the event of a critical event, like an October 1. Our training and response protocols have been enhanced as it relates to investigations, traffic safety and education, dispatch, patrols, and other areas in order to allow the department to perform its work independently and without reliance on other agencies to the extent possible. As the consolidation model continues to evolve and mature, the department will, generally speaking, be in a position to provide public safety and related support for all of our on-campus events without support from other agencies. Next slide. I am also advocating for a review of models that will divert nonviolent calls to service away from police services to other appropriate non-law enforcement groups that utilize trained specialists, such as the Jean Nidich Women's Center at UNLV and the department's homeless outreach teams, rather than patrol officers. And this is an attempt to connect people in need with services to help address underlying issues that may not be law enforcement related. Next slide, please. So I've been a lifelong proponent of reasonable police reform, really long before it was popular to do so. In the last 16 months since my appointment to this position, I've worked diligently to increase transparency at UPD, to recruit and hire officers who reflect our diverse campuses, and I continue to be laser focused on changing the police culture that prevents police officers from holding each other accountable. I'm committed to continuing to work hard to earn the trust of our campuses. And to that end, I testified on August 1st for the special session of the legislature in support of Nevada's police reform bill, AB 3. I've been working with the UNLV Anti-Black Racism Task Force at establishing a campus response team, which will be comprised of students, faculty, and staff, who will serve as an alternative response to university police services at campus protests and demonstrations in an effort to ensure a welcoming environment for students and others who wish to exercise their constitutional rights on campus. I've also engaged with the Center for Democratic Culture in the Forest Trajectory Project in Las Vegas to determine what your beliefs are and how we can best work together to achieve change within my department and law enforcement in general. Next slide. I've drafted, along with my colleague, Chief Renwick in Northern Command, a system policy which will, if approved, establish a campus review board. The board will review disciplinary actions by University Police Administration compliance with Nevada Revised Statute 396.3291. I hope to have this policy before the board for approval yet later this fall. Next slide. And in order to seek input from students, faculty, and staff, as well as other community members on police operations and community interaction, and in an effort to develop collaborative relationships and establish and maintain meaningful associations with campuses that we serve, I have proposed, and all four presidents in Southern Command have approved, the establishment of a police advisory board, similar to what we had established in Northern Nevada. Volunteers from across Southern Nevada have expressed an interest in serving on this board, and we will begin accepting nominations for that board next week. Wanted to, Chair Page, thank you over the years for your support of University Police Services when I was director in Northern Nevada and now in Southern Nevada. So thank you very much for your support. That concludes my report. I'm available for any questions if you have them.
Thanks, Chief. Any questions for the Chief? I've got a question about training now after the Floyd situation. Have you guys made major changes?
Well, yeah, that's a good question, Chair. So kind of let me back up. Like I said, I've been a lifelong proponent of reasonable change within policing. And if we as a nation and a community and an institution truly want change in policing, there are a couple things that we have to do. One is we have to hire the right people. And I think that we're well on doing that. We are very, very selective in who we are hiring. We don't necessarily look at people who are trained from other agencies. We just want the right person who can fit in this kind of environment, who can be a police officer in a community-oriented policing agency. Second, we have to have policies that hold our employees accountable and then hold them accountable to those policies. Third, and this is kind of the crux of where you've come from, we have to change the training protocols. Training should use community policing as the foundational model, emphasizing verbal and physical de-escalation, diversity, social justice, and ethical behavior. And I believe that the time is now for us to do that. I have discussed with President Zaragoza the CSN Regional Police Academy. It is the only regional academy, by the way, in Southern Nevada. I believe that CSN can emerge from this, these events, is a national and a regional leader in training. So I do look forward to working with President Zaragoza in the future. One of the issues that we have talked about is targeting CCSD minority students to enter law enforcement through a proactive and dual enrollment academy pathway. So those are things that we're going to be working on as we move into the future as it relates to training in Southern Nevada. As it relates to what we've done here, absolutely. Well, we are looking at the events that have occurred throughout the country and using that as training springboards to change what we do and how we do it.
Thank you. Any questions from the institution?
Chair Page, President Patterson.
Good morning, President Patterson.
Chief Garcia, and I think you alluded to this in your presentation, and I think Chief Renwick also discussed the training aspect. Could you talk a little bit about training and policing related to mental health issues?
Yes, we've been, there is mandatory training that the Peace Officer Standards and Training Board requires of law enforcement agencies in Nevada to undergo. So we do complete the mandatory training. And much like in Northern Nevada, as training presents itself, officers either are required to attend training, in particular as it relates to mental health issues, or they self-volunteer to go. We have been looking at the different kind of training protocols that are out there that are sufficient for what we do and how we do it, and we've been working with our folks at UNLV to determine which training is available here, how we can work together as an agency in the campus to move forward in dealing with those issues.
Thank you.
Of course.
Seeing no other questions, thank you, Chief. We are now going to go to agenda item number 5, NC cybersecurity information only.
We've got a solid presentation today. Into your presentation,
Magoo. I'm sorry? Can you speak up? Is someone ready to present for agenda item number 6? Is there a way we could check with Teresa?
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
Doing well, yourself?
I'm doing well, thank you. For the record, my name is Teresa Simmons, and I am the NC Chief Information Security Officer. And our primary positions and purpose here is to provide shared security services for the institutions who request it, and to provide direct security services for system and computing services and the system administration. When it became evident that the pandemic was going to affect the teaching, learning, and working environment for faculty, staff, and students, institutional IT departments moved quickly to adapt to the new norm of teaching, learning, and working remotely. Beginning on March 16th of this year, NC institutions demonstrated creativity, resourcefulness, ingenuity when addressing the challenges involved with providing remote access to IT institutional resources for faculty, students, and staff. In addition, they had to ensure that security and privacy were baked into those resources that they deployed to everyone. Gratefully for the institutions, this occurred during spring break, which gave them a bit of breathing room to adapt, configure, and deploy resources to allow their users to work remotely. The institutional IT departments provided resources to roughly 10,700 faculty, 4,900 staff, and over 100,000 students. This was no small feat, and they accomplished it seamlessly. Institutions allowed faculty, staff, and students to take home institutionally assigned computers and check out equipment such as laptops and Chromebooks. In many cases, additional laptops, Chromebooks, and peripherals such as webcams, keyboards, monitors, mice, and printers had to be purchased to meet the demand. Other special purchases included hotspots and Microsoft Surface Go's to provide internet services to those who did not have internet access. The above mentioned had to be inventoried, cataloged, signed out, loaded and configured with institutional software before they could be given to the users. In some cases, users used their own personal devices because there were not enough devices to go around. This posed a security issue in that they were not managed by central IT, and there was no way to determine if they met the institutional security policies. Users were instructed on what was required when using their personal device. Because users were no longer on the campus network, but instead were using their personal internet, services and software were installed on the devices to protect the data being transmitted to the institution's IT resources and the user. For example, a VPN, which is also known as a virtual private network, is a software client that can be installed on devices. This was done on many of the devices, particularly those whose users had responsibilities to handle confidential data. Those users were taught how to use that client so that they could connect. And what a VPN does is it creates a tunnel or a shell around the data that's being transmitted and encrypts that data so that only the sender and the receiver can view it. In some cases, VPNs weren't possible, so IT had to set up what is known as remote desktop. In that case, the remote computer connects to a desktop on the campus, and that desktop provides the services and the resources that they need to do their work. Institutions requested remote working guidelines and information that they could share with their users. The NSHE Information Security Office produced a document titled Remote Readiness When Working from Home. This document provided guidelines and expectations for users to follow and use. The document was sent to the Information Security Advisory Committee and the Information Securities Council, who then disseminated it to their users and constituents. The transition to working remotely, although seamless for the most part, was not without its challenges. Along with purchasing and assigning and checking out IT resources, IT departments provided training on how to use a VPN or how to connect to a remote desktop, how to set up video conference meetings for courses, how to set up course shells for the online learning management systems. And for those machines not centrally managed and protected by the institution's IT department, users were provided instructions and guidelines to keep their devices current and up to date with the latest security patches. For those devices that were centrally managed, processes and software were already implemented and activated to ensure the systems were all current with patches. And this could be done remotely, which was wonderful. In response to requests for the ability to download information out of Workday to be able to conduct business remotely, NSHE-SCS removed restrictions that only allowed access within the institutional IP address ranges. This allowed for greater flexibility and provided the needed tools for which employees could complete their job functions. I can honestly say there were many, many happy people when we did this. One of the greatest challenges was providing video conference tools for remote classroom instruction and work use. In addition to Canvas, a learning management system, tools such as WebEx, Google Hangout, and Meet, Zoom, BlueJeans, WebEx were used. Unfortunately, there were issues with the free version of Zoom. Three institutions had occurrences of Zoom bombing. Zoom bombing is when a bad actor accesses a session that is in play and attempts to hijack the session by inserting inappropriate materials. Those materials can be racist, lewd, whatever, and it literally creates chaos within that session. Thankfully, the professors closed out the sessions, notified the IT department and their leadership. The IT departments moved quickly for remediation. They implemented stronger security measures on the software, and they also taught the users how to create meetings where you would have to have a password to access, or how to set up a meeting room where those that wanted to access that session had to be admitted. This helped to prevent any more feature occurrences of Zoom. The NSHE General Counsel asked the Information Security Office to produce a document to help share with the institutions on how to protect themselves from this. And this was created. It was titled Security Tips for Common Virtual Collaboration Tools, that provided directions and tips for securing video conference tools such as Zoom, BlueJeans, Teams, and WebEx. This article was published on the NSHE website and was shared with institutional presidents who shared it with their constituents. On April 7th, Zoom finally implemented stronger security measures into its free and enterprise versions. Many of the institutions chose, after those incidents, to purchase enterprise license to help prevent any further occurrences. It should be noted that although they're called Zoom bombings, these can also happen within any other type of video conferencing tools. So it just happened to be that it started with Zoom and it was affiliated with the brand Zoom. In June, the Information Security Office was notified by one of the institutions that some of their employees were victims of unemployment claims fraud. Criminals were using the employee's identity of the institution's employees to file for unemployment claims. The Nevada Department of Employment, Training, and Rehabilitation had sent the claims to the institution's HR department to validate that the individuals filing a claim had been terminated. A quick check of other institutions showed they were experiencing the same scenario. This was reported to Adam Garcia, Todd Renwick, and General Counsel. Currently, each institution is gathering a list of those who have been affected. Those names will be given to the Nevada Attorney General's Office and to the Department of Employment, Training, and Rehabilitation. At this point, we do not have a full count of the employees who were affected. Each institution has provided those affected with resources that they can use to protect themselves from further harm. It needs to be noted that this is a nationwide issue and is not specific to NSHE. The same is with the Zoom bombings. Those happened across the nation. To prepare for the fall semester, institutional IT departments re-imaged devices to ensure they were compliant with policy. They also purchased additional laptops, Chromebooks, and peripherals for remote teaching and learning and working and for hybrid classrooms. Some institutions provided training during the summer for enhancing remote hybrid classroom instruction, as well as other training regarding how to work safely from home. When the question was posed, what is needed to help facilitate a safer, more robust environment for working and learning remotely, the institutions responded with three key items. The top one was a need for policies and standards related to working from home or remotely, and guidelines for the use of personally owned devices to connect NSHE business. The second one was the need to virtualize applications and software for coursework and lab. And what is meant by that, quite often there are expensive licenses such as AutoCAD, Mathematica, ArcGIS, where students cannot afford to purchase those and institutions cannot afford to purchase the site license because it's too expensive. But what they can purchase are concurrent licenses, which they can put onto a server, and students and faculty and staff can log into that server, access the software, and perform the work or the assignments that they need to do with this. So they are in the process of looking at this, checking out to see what the cost is and so forth. The third one was the need for consistent, reliable internet service. In many rural, remote areas, the internet connectivity is sporadic or non-existent. It should be noted that the NG network is robust and is strong and does very good coverage within the institution areas, but is not able to reach out to specific individuals. So that was one of the reasons why they bought the hotspots, why they bought the Surface Go's, so those people who did not have that type of service would be able to use it. And I want to point out, while the pandemic is not a cyber incident in that it caused harm to our faculty, staff, and workers, it was an incident. It is an incident nonetheless. And the IT departments really stepped up their game for the incident response. The swiftness and the agility that they displayed in getting all of these systems ready for the users was amazing. They did it with a smile on their face. For example, UNLV realized the need for many students who had to have a Chromebook. And they literally spent 2 days checking out Chromebooks to students so those students would have the resources to access the necessary things for their coursework. So I think the IT departments needed to be commended for the services that they provided to everyone. It was above and beyond what is normally expected of them. So with that, I will conclude my talk and I am open for questions.
Thank you, Teresa. Any questions from the board? Any of the institutions? Teresa, I've got a quick question. When
yes.
you saw your presentation, you said that it was an option if the institutions wanted to use USS services. Who uses it and who doesn't?
Okay, can you repeat that again, please?
Sure, when you started your presentation, you had mentioned that it was optional whether the institutions use your cybersecurity services. And I'd be curious to see which ones use it, which ones, which don't.
It varies. For the most part, the community colleges use the shared services that we have, which is we do vulnerability scanning for all of them. We also do threat management for them. We also provide training for them. The larger universities, depending on what they need, will ask for it. UNR is pretty stable and can stand on their own. They have a good IT force or a good security force that is pretty robust. UNLV does look to us for help on certain things. We've done other things besides the vulnerability scanning. We've also provided external scanning using resources from the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, web scanning services from what's known as DorkBot, which is provided by the University of Texas. All of those have been effective in providing a security posture for the institutions and giving them a view of what others are seeing from the outside of their network. We've also provided documentation for them in regards to an incident response procedure, which they have used and implemented, and has been particularly useful when they go through the audits because they have documentation that they can produce. And we're also in the process of doing other things. We've worked with them on GLBA. We've provided documentation and training required for that. So we just keep growing.
Thank you. And then just one follow-up question. Have we had many instances of people looking for ransom for data?
Not that I am aware of. I am looking to secure some training for ransomware through RenISAC. It would be an online course that's going to last a day, and it would actually be an incident response blended threat type workshop where it'll involve more than just IT people. I was going to present that at the Information Security Advisory Committee meeting next Wednesday. But it is something that'll give them good insight on what they need to do as far as protecting themselves against ransomware and what to do should they be hit with ransomware.
Thank you so much. Nice report, Teresa. We will go to agenda item number 7, new business information only. Anything for new business?
CNN, yes.
Thank you. We will go to agenda number public comment. And I see no emails or texts on that. So we will go and see about adjourning the meeting. Thank you so much.